Welcome to the Ghostly Gallery Podcast, a place where we explore the world of horror in film, television, literature, and popular culture. Well, greetings, everyone. My name is Bruce Markison. As always, I'm joined by our co-host and producer, Tracy Asteria. Tracy, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Bruce. Did you know that today is Superhero Day?
No idea. Superhero Day. Every day is something. Yeah,
I know. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking about, you know, horror superheroes. And I think one that came to my mind was Constantine. I don't know if he's like the perfect example, but I was like, oh, that's so fascinating. So I wanted to wish you a happy superhero day. So
I love that movie, Constantine, by the way. Keanu Reeves is in that. It's a great, great movie. They've been talking about doing some sort of a follow-up, which I hope happens. That's an excellent, excellent movie. And it's based on comic strip, right? Longtime comic strip.
It is, definitely.
Yeah, that's definitely falls into the category of horror superhero. Trying to think of some others. There aren't that many that really kind of cross those two genres.
No, I know. I was trying to think about some of the different ones, and I tried to do a little bit of research, but there wasn't a lot that came up. But when I thought of Constantine, I'm like, that's probably my primary example there for horror superheroes.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I think it's one of the best horror films of the 21st century that we're in right now. That's just right up at the top of the list. All right, very good. So happy Superhero Day to all. Very important day that it is. More important for our purposes is tonight's guest. And this episode features a return visit from our friend Josh Hitchens. Josh is an accomplished historian, writer, theater director, actor, playwright, among other things. He's authored several books in the Haunted America series and has also performed numerous one-man plays about a variety of subjects, including Dracula, Frankenstein, The Legends of Sleepy Hollow, among others. Josh, welcome back to the Ghostly Gallery Podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's awesome to be back with you both again. Thanks for having me.
And Josh, very important, you're now in the lead in terms of the number of guest appearances. This is appearance number 3, and that pushes you ahead of several others that are tied at 2. So this is a significant milestone for which you will be rewarded with a cheap prize at some point. So look for that in the mail.
Thank you so much. Oh, it's an honor. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. So third visit with Josh Hitchens. And today we're going to talk about a very specific subject within the genre of horror. We're going to put the focus on a production company called Amicus Productions. It was a studio that produced a number of excellent horror films back in the 1960s and 70s. They are best known for producing a series of 7 anthology films, many of which really still are among the best in this subgenre. Each of these anthologies generally featured 4 to 5 short stories, usually linked to some kind of a common theme. These films were known for being beautifully shot, having very high production values, and featuring all-star casts filled with really brand-name British actors. And this was accomplished despite the fact that this production company basically had 2 main employees. That was it. Milton Sabotsky and Max Rosenberg were the leaders, and they, and I guess their personal secretaries, were just about the only ones on the payroll for most of this time. And yet they were able to put out these beautifully done films. So, Josh, as we start things off, do you remember when you first became aware of Amicus and what they were achieving with these really nicely done anthologies?
I do. The very first time I was exposed to Amicus Productions was watching AMC or American Movie Classics, as it was then known back when they, really showed classic movies all the time. Not so much now. But I think it was a late, like Saturday afternoon, I think when I was like 11 or 12, somewhere around there. And I happened to catch Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which was the first anthology film that they made. And I just really loved it, loved the atmosphere. I loved the whole concept of, the horror anthology film or portmanteau film. Some people call them that too. Because, you get all these, little stories, so you can get a little bit of everything, instead of having a movie about a single subject, you can have a movie that has, vampires in it and witches and mummies and all, disembodied body parts, crawling around. You can have all of that in one movie. And I love the idea of the framing device too, that sort of connects everything together. So it's ever since then been a favorite subgenre of horror of mine.
Well, you mentioned that first film that came out, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. And Tracy is going to kick things off by asking you a little bit more about that movie. Now, that movie came out the year I was born, 1965, but I didn't see it until many years later. Tracy is, of course, decades younger than me, but still recalls the movie. Tracy, take it away.
Oh my gosh. So I'll be completely honest. I just saw this movie for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And of course, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, directed by Freddie Francis. And it has like five stories, and it includes absolutely everything you can think of. So did you want to start talking about the first couple of stories, Josh?
Sure, yeah. I also think just with Amicus in general too, I think it's a hoot that like it was this British production company, but both Sabatsky and Rosenberg were American. But yet they employed all these, top tier British, actors and directors, and writers too. So because they saw that, oh, Hammer's making all this money. So let's try and do that, but they ventured into, a genre that Hammer didn't really cover so much. But yeah, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors starts kind of strangers on a train-esque kind of beginning. There are five men who are on a late night train, and for whatever reason, they decide to all cram into one, cabin on this train, very, very tight fit. And in the cabin with them, one of the people is a mysterious man who calls himself Dr. Terror, who is played by, of course, horror legend Peter Cushing, the first of his many appearances in Amicus films. His real name is Dr. Schreck, which is, again, which ger translate German means terror, nod, of course, to Max Schreck in the original Nosferatu as well. But he drops his bag and all these cards come out and people are like, what are these? And Christopher Lee, who's in this film as well, so recognizes them and recognizes them as tarot cards. And so basically the premise of the movie is that Dr. Terror is telling the fortune of each of the men on the train. And based on the cards that he pulls, then we get the story of what's going to happen. But all the stories end with the same card, which is death. Yeah, the first story in it is just simply called Werewolf, in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, and it's one of my favorite ones, in the film, because I think it's hugely atmospheric. And again, that's Freddie Francis, because he's an amazing Oscar-winning cinematographer as well, of course. But so really, really knows what to do with the camera, really knows how to just trowel on the atmosphere. And that story is about a man who's an architect who's summoned back to his ancestral home, which has, previously been sold to a woman because she wants to do some renovations on the house. So he goes back to consult with her and ends up uncovering a legend of a werewolf named Cosmo Valdemar, which is a fantastic name. And they discover the werewolf's coffin in the basement, which fittingly has a wolf's head on it. And the werewolf gets loose and starts creating mayhem. But that's the basic premise of the first story.
Oh my gosh. I thought it was a pretty cool story, honestly. You know, for the first one in the movie, I that's when I kind of fell in love with that movie, was that very first story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Like when I first saw it, I was like, oh, this is great. I love this. You know, even though it's obviously, you know, these movies were not high budget by any stretch of the imagination, you know, and the werewolf is, when you see it, like, it's just obviously close up of like a dog's face, snarling, but it's lit really cool. You know, because, you know, again, Freddie Francis is great at making things look good. But yeah. And again, with all of these stories and all these films, there's always a little twist at the end of each thing, you know, and at the end of each story. So it sort of leaves you like, oh, wow. And then sort of fade to black. And you're like, whoa, wow, what a story that was. And I think the twist in the werewolf story is a very good one. And one I think that at least the first time I saw it, I was not expecting, you know, the end to be of that story to be what it was. That, yeah. I was like, oh, this is neat. I'm here for it.
Exactly. That's kind of how I felt too. I did not expect that ending to that first story. So I thought it was like beautifully well shot too, just like Bruce mentioned in the intro.
In addition to werewolves in this one, we have some other monsters. We have vampires. We also have a story of voodoo. So it's pretty eclectic. It covers a wide range of themes. I'm not sure what your favorite segment is, whether it's the werewolf one or one of the others, but I'll tell you what mine was. I like the one called Disembodied Hand, and that stars Christopher Lee. And then the British actor, and I'm never sure how to pronounce his last name, Michael, is it Goff or Go? Do you know, Josh?
You know, that's a great question. I'm not sure if I've ever heard his last name actually said aloud, even though I love him and I've seen him in a million things, including, of course, he's Alfred in the Tim Burton Batman movies. I've always in my head said Michael Gow, but that's probably not right.
Well, it could be. Yeah. It could be. Yeah, he was a great actor. He is pitted against Christopher Lee. Interesting here, Lee plays against type because while he takes on the role of an arrogant and kind of overbearing art critic, he really becomes the victim in his story. So he's not the villain, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to say like Werewolf and Disembodied Hand are definitely my two favorites in this particular anthology. A lot of the reasons you mentioned, you know, you have, you know, though Christopher Lee playing against type, as Peter Cushing is too in this movie. So they're sort of reversing their Hammer roles, you know, because typically in Hammer, Christopher Lee was the bad guy, Peter Cushing was the good guy. But in this movie, they're flipped, which is very interesting. But Disembodied Hand, I think, is great too, because it's basically almost like a two-hander, you know, in a lot of ways between Christopher Lee and Michael Gow. Like there's like extras at like, you know, the art gallery showings and such, you know, but other than that, it's just the two of them. And then it becomes just Christopher Lee and the Disembodied Hand, which is, and I think the Disembodied Hand effect, however they did it, is quite effective for 1965.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Another significant actor here, a guy that we don't necessarily associate with horror films, though he would do some later ones, Don't Look Now and the great movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but a very young Donald Sutherland. I guess it's a little jarring to see him. He's young. I don't think he's really well known at this point, but he does a good job, too.
Yeah, no, it is crazy to see him. So I think I don't know if it was this was his first film, but it was definitely one of his first. And yeah, he's shocking how young he is. And like knowing, of course, all the great things he would go on to do later on in his career, you know, in horror and otherwise, it's really cool to see him. And that, I think that's one of the fun things about these Amicus films as well, because you have like these veteran British movie and theater actors, but you also have, younger actors who weren't known at the time who would become much more well known. So it's a really, really fun mix, I think.
So this was Amicus's first crack at anthologies. I don't think it's the strongest of them all, but it's a good effort. It's a pretty good way to wade into the water and get started. And certainly, I think it's a good film. I think it's a real good, solid anthology. Then 2 years later, Amicus produces its second anthology. And this one is called Torture Garden. It's a great title, but it's completely misleading. There's no garden and there's no torture. But what the film does do, it presents four short stories. They're all tied to the common thread of a haunted house attraction run by this sinister carnival barker named Dr. Diabolo. And he's played by the great Burgess Meredith. And, if Burgess Meredith is in it, it's got to be pretty decent.
Yeah, no, I agree. For me, like, I think Burgess Meredith is my favorite part of Torture Garden. Like he's so wonderful in it, and similarly of how Peter Cushing was great as Dr. Terror, Burgess Meredith is just so deliciously sinister as Dr. Diabolo, and you can tell he's having the time of his life doing this. This because this was like at the peak of, the 60s Batman TV series fame, where he, played the Penguin, of course. And
Right.
you can see a little bit of the Penguin in his performance here. Like there's even the same like long cigarette holder kind of deal that he does. I think he's great. And like he really like holds this Torture Garden together for me. I'm curious to hear both of your thoughts on it, because I think Torture Garden is actually my least favorite of the Amicus films. For me, like it feels a little bit too close to the formula of Dr. Terror. Like, and the stories all have interesting things about them. I don't know if they're executed as well as in some of the other films. But I do love the final one called The Man Who Collected Poe. I think is that I really find that one very interesting. But otherwise, not my personal favorite, but I'm curious to know what y'all think.
I think you're right. I've heard a lot of people say this is probably the weakest of Amicus's anthologies. Not to say that it's bad, it's just not as
No.
strong as the others. And I would also agree that that last story, the Edgar Allan Poe story with Jack Palance, who's fantastic in this, I think that is the best of the stories. So you've got Palance, you've got Peter Cushing, you've got Burgess Meredith. It's also written by a great writer, the guy who wrote the Psycho book, and that would be Robert Bloch, who contributed to many of Amicus's anthologies. So some great individuals here, but the total sum is maybe less than what it should have been. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because, since Robert Bloch went on to write the scripts for two more of these films, including the one that was made after this, the third one, both of which I think are really good. Yeah, I find it curious that like the just the maybe he was still getting used to this format. I don't know, but it's don't they it the stories in this one don't hit quite the same for me.
I'm curious, Josh, what you think of Jack Palance in general. We don't necessarily think of him as a horror actor, but he did appear in a number of horror films. He did the Dan Curtis version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was in the 1974 film Dracula that we've talked about several times on this show. We tend to think of him as villainous characters, but maybe more in dramas than in horror. What do you think of his contribution to horror?
I mean, I definitely think like he's made his mark. Like you're right. Like he's not talked about in the way that we talk about, big names like, Cushing and Lee and Vincent Price and all those folks. But he's done some really solid, memorable work. Especially I think the Dracula film I think is really interesting and a very interesting take on the character.
Yeah. One of the roles I really liked him in was the Batman movie with Michael Keaton. And Jack Palance played the leader of the local mob in Gotham, and he was Jack Nicholson's boss. And I remember him delivering a line to Jack Nicholson, you are my number one guy. And that was sort of a signal that Nicholson was going to be set up for his own death, but turned out not to be the case. I thought he was great in that.
Yes, he is. You're absolutely right.
All right. So that's Torture Garden. So really probably the weakest of the seven anthologies we're talking about on this show. Then a leap up in my mind to the next one, 1971. I really enjoy this one, and it's called The House That Dripped Blood. As Josh indicated, also written by the legendary Robert Bloch, this features four stories. In this case, they're tied to a sinister old house in the English countryside. The former residents of the house have either died or disappeared, including a very famous actor. So that leads a Scotland Yard detective to visit the premises and start conducting an in-depth investigation. I love this one. Let's get your thoughts on it, Josh.
I love it too. I think it is. I think there are two. There are two of these Amicus anthologies that are like just straight up great horror movies, and this is the first of those two for me. I feel like this is where House That Dripped Blood is really where Amicus found their groove as far as this format. You know, I think with Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, they found this thing like, oh, we're good at this. And then Torture Garden, they kind of tried to reproduce the format of Dr. Terror a little too closely, I think. But in the House That Dripped Blood, they break out of that. You know, they break out of sort of having this main antagonist kind of character, and instead the antagonist is the house itself. And like you said, the detective who's investigating all these weird murders or strange deaths that have occurred within it. So the framework of it is a lot looser, which I think allows the stories themselves to really shine and to be, again, really, really individualized. I love the first story in this one called Method for Murder, which is about a mystery writer played by the great, great actor Denholm Elliott, who specializes in murder mysteries and so loves this creepy old house, moves there with his beautiful young wife, and he starts writing this story about Dominic, who is a strangler who laughs maniacally as he's strangling people. And then he starts to see Dominic first outside the house and then within it. And just, I find the figure of Dominic in it, like, and the laugh he has, like, actually very unnerving and creepy. I love that one a lot. I love all the stories in this, but I also, my second favorite would probably be the final one, which is called The Cloak, starring John Pertwee, of course, most famous for being the third incarnation of Doctor Who. And he plays this sort of hammy horror movie actor who's playing a vampire who goes to this shop and buys this cloak from a very creepy proprietor.
Right.
And he puts on the cloak and then shows symptoms of actually turning into a vampire. And what's fun about The Cloak is that when they were making this film, so this is the first movie in the Amicus anthologies that isn't directed by Freddie Francis. It's directed by a man named Peter DeFell, and of course written by Robert Bloch. But the director, especially with The Cloak, was directing it to be funny, as if it was a comedy. And then Milton Subotsky and Max Rosenberg, you know, saw what they were doing. It's like, no, you can't do this. It's meant to be scary. It can't be funny. So then they had to like change a lot of what they were doing. But you can still see, I think, little indications of the comedy in there, like Pertwee especially, like,
yeah,
is really amusing in this. And I love, and that The Cloak also features, of course, you know, very, very famous Hammer horror icon here in Amicus as well, Ingrid Pitt, who's fantastic also. But yeah, those are my two favorites from this one, personally.
I want to go back to the last story, the cloak, but let's talk more about Dominic. I could see a whole movie centered on him as the villain. And I don't recall the name of the actor who played Dominic. I don't think he's particularly famous, but he's really good. And of course, it stirs up this whole idea. Is Denholm Elliott imagining this villainous character that seems to be staring at him and stalking him? Or is he really there? What exactly is going? And then they give you a little bit of a twist when they reveal exactly who Dominic is. I thought that was highly effective. First time I watched it, that was a big twist.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. And I just looked it up. Tom Adams is the name of the actor who played Dominic. Apparently well known for the movie The Great Escape from 1963, which I have not seen, but I should now. But yeah, like that, the twist when you find out who Dominic is so great. But then, and then there's another twist after that at the very end to fade to black, which I, again, like, I think is so fun and just starts the movie off on such a strong, strong note.
That's right. I had forgotten there was a double whammy there at the end of that first story. And then with the last story, The Cloak, and John Pertwee, as you mentioned, he plays the actor who has gone missing, which prompts the Scotland Yard detective to begin this investigation in the first place. And Pertwee is supposed to be this great actor, but he's really kind of lousy. He's hammy and so over the top. I mean, he's not a great actor, even though he thinks he is. But they treat him like royalty because he's like the key to the film. If they don't have him, they don't have a movie.
Yeah, and the fun thing too is that one of my favorite bits of trivia about this is that John Pertwee based his performance on Christopher Lee, who he was friends with. So it was sort of like an affectionate parody of Christopher Lee, because Christopher Lee, you know, especially with Hammer and Dracula, he got sick of doing it after a while. So like you can see a little bit of that in Pertwee's character in The Cloak.
All right, you mentioned Christopher Lee. He's featured in one of the stories, although he's not in the same scenes with Cushing or Elliot or Pertwee. So he moves into this house, and he moves in with his young daughter, who for whatever reason cannot go to school. She has to be homeschooled by sort of a nanny slash professor type. And he kind of comes across as a little bit cold and unfeeling, but then they throw another twist at you involving the daughter. And I thought that was a kind of a quietly effective story too.
I think so too. And again, it's, you know, it's the first one in the movie that in the Amicus anthologies that starts playing with the idea of witchcraft in very interesting ways. Certainly won't be the last one. But the fact that it's centered around a child too, and you're not really sure until the end, like what is the dynamic between him and his daughter? Is he this, you know, puritanical parent who's like keeping his daughter locked away, or is it something else, or is it a combination of both? You don't know to the end. And again, it's such a great ending, to this one for sure.
Another story, and it's kind of overshadowed here, but it stars Peter Cushing. It's the second segment, which is called Waxworks. And for those who have ever seen the promotional poster for The House That Dripped Blood, this is the story that's featured in that very famous poster. You see a head being served up for dinner by a skeletal female figure, and it's actually Peter Cushing's head. So it all refers to this segment where he starts to become, suspicious of a local wax museum. And it sort of ties into a past love that he had. What did you think of that story?
I really enjoy it. Yeah, again, I think all the stories in this film, I think, are very, very strong, you know, from top to bottom. But yeah, I think this one's really fun, you know, I feel like that's like a subgenre of a subgenre in a way, like, you know, the whole like creepy waxwork museum, you know, with, oh, wow, they look so lifelike, I wonder why, you know, but like, pardon me, like, it's been done in a lot of movies and TV shows, but it always works, I think. Like it's always such an effective thing. And I think too, what makes this one, In the House That Dripped Blood, work quite well, in a different way than, you see this kind of story otherwise, is that there's more of like a personal emotional connection to what's going on. I don't want to, spoil it and say what it is, but I think that it adds like a lovely little, bloody cherry on top, to this story.
I think, Josh, one of the real strengths of this movie is the house itself, which is prominently featured in the first story with Denholm Elliott, but they return to it for each of the segments. It's just a wonderfully gothic house. It's a great backdrop. It must have been at the Shepperton Studios where Amicus was based out of. I just love the house, both the exteriors that they showed, the interiors. I think it's one of my favorite haunted houses or gothic houses I've seen in film history. I think it's really a strength.
Yeah, I 100% agree. The fact that the house, just the way it looks like, becomes a character in itself that maybe is either causing these events to happen or is attracting, these specific people to it, for different reasons. It's never really gone into in the film. It's sort of just this unsettling sort of, thing that is covering everything. And I love that the realtor's name is Stoker, in the house. Again, lovely little in joke. And just terrific writing by Robert Block in this film all the way through.
Yeah, very much so. Strong gothic atmosphere throughout, vivid imagery. It's a film that provides us with a wide range of monsters and themes. You've got a boogeyman, you've got a witch, you've got a pair of vampires. I'll come out and say it. It's my favorite of the Amicus anthologies. I know you like it. Do you put it at the top or near the top?
For me, it's tough. I'd pro it's either number one or a tie for number one with another one. I think it's just extremely good.
So that's The House That Dripped Blood from 1971. And as Josh mentioned, by this point, Amicus had really found its groove. They had hit their stride with these films. So they have a strong follow-up that comes to us in 1972, and it's called Tales from the Crypt. Not connected to the HBO series of many years later, though it is based on the EC comic stories from the 1950s. So this film presents five stories involving people taking a tour of a strange crypt-like catacombs. There they encounter an even stranger man who is known as the Crypt Keeper. Let's get your thoughts on Tales from the Crypt, Josh.
Yeah, so alongside The House That Dripped Blood, I think Tales from the Crypt is the other, like, just top to bottom, great, great movie. I don't know if I could rank them, which would be number one, which would be number two. I think they're kind of both equally brilliant, because I think House That Dripped Blood, you have, just flawless writing, from Robert Block, adapting in most cases his own short stories. But in Tales from the Crypt, I think it's, again, another evolution in the chapter of the Amicus anthology films, and that they discovered the amazing treasure trove of material from EC Comics, from Tales from the Crypt, from Vault of Horror, Shock Suspense Stories, and others, which, for anyone who may not know, it's a fascinating story in its own right. Like, EC Comics was most famous in the 1950s for its horror comics, which were very, very graphic, in terms of what they depicted, both like with violence and horror and sexuality. Also very progressive, in terms of race relations for the 1950s as well. And that's part of what got them eventually censored and shut down. Which is weird, because the thing about all the EC Comics stories is that they're morality tales, essentially. Like, if you do something bad, you're going to be punished for it, probably in a very, very horrible way. So it, makes great, great material for a horror anthology film. And I love Tales from the Crypt. We have Freddie Francis back as director again. And even though like House That Dripped Blood is well directed, like again, Freddie Francis really like just has brings a visual style that I think is on another level, and like again, like knows atmosphere and framing that's really gets how to do this material effectively. And it has the great, Ralph Richardson as the Crypt Keeper, which, for folks who were initially exposed to Tales from the Crypt with the 1990s HBO show, as I was watching it way too young without my parents knowing. So you're used to from that show, you're used to like the very like decomposing corpse kind of looking Crypt Keeper, played by John Cassier, who's iconic. But Ralph Richardson plays him in a very different way. He's almost like a monk-like kind of presence, which is equally like unsettling, and in a very different, more subtle way. But yeah, it's these five people who are touring, these old catacombs in England, and of course the tour guide is like, "Stay close so you don't lose your way," and of course they don't listen, and find themselves lost and locked in this part of the catacombs with the crypt keeper, who tells them about horrible things that are going to happen leading to their deaths, with of course a twist at the end of the frame story. But yeah, I think this is again full of really, really strong tales, this movie.
Yeah, all five stories are good. Do you have a favorite among them, Josh?
I mean, I you both know how much I love An All Through the House. We talked about it on the Christmas horror episode.
Yeah.
I
Joan
do,
Collins.
yeah, Joan Collins being fantastic in it. And like I said then, like I think, and all through the house, like many of these sequences in the Amicus movies do, like could be like just like 12 to 15-minute short films on their own. They're that strong. I think is that that's what makes the movie so fun, is that you have all these incredibly strong, complete stories that are being told, and you just get, five of them all together. It's like a, rich meal. But yeah, I love An All Through the House, which is again almost like a one person showcase for Joan Collins. Like the daughter is in and out. You have the killer Santa Claus that you see periodically, but for most of it's just her, and there's not a lot of dialogue in it. It's mostly like the Christmas music, which contrasts to her trying to both killing her husband and then trying to cover up the crime, so no one notices, her daughter doesn't see it. Yeah, re really effective. So I love An All Through the House. I love the third story, Poetic Justice. Which I think I would say has some of Peter Cushing's finest acting, I think, ever is in that sequence. He made this movie not long after the death of his wife. So he was still in that period of mourning, and you really see that in the story. Like there's this aching vulnerability to Cushing's work in this that I don't think you quite see in anything else he did. Like it doesn't feel like it's acting, it feels like he's being. So it has a wonderful performance by him, and just an incredible final twist that happens, which is so typical EC Comics, in that it is both, again, morality tale, but also like very gruesome, and but also like humorous in a way too. It's this lovely mixture of like fun and horror, which I think is so typical of these works.
For those who haven't seen Tales from the Crypt, Josh is talking about the story where Peter Cushing plays a character named Arthur Grimsdyke. And he's sort of like a caretaker, and he's a friend to the neighborhood children. But for some reason, some of the elite people in the neighborhood come to resent him. They want to get rid of him. They want to make him quit. And they just treat him so abominably. I mean, you mention the death of his wife, and then you think about how his character gets treated here, and he's just masterful in the way that he plays the Grimsdyke character. But he's able to exact some supernatural revenge that he's able to plot against his tormentors. And I agree with you. I think it's one of Cushing's best performances, even though it's not a full-length film. It's just a short story, but he's really phenomenal there. Another story, Josh, I wanted to mention here in Tales from the Crypt, I think is pretty good. Patrick McGee plays a sightless man who lives in a home for the blind. And this is another tale of a boss, the guy who runs this home for the blind, is just awful. He's a terrible proprietor. He tortures the elderly residents who can't see, and they're infirm, and he just has absolutely no sympathy. I mean, you really almost want something bad to happen to him.
And it does. I agree. Like, especially this file story, Blind Alleys, like, I think has the most genuinely frightening moment in the entire Amicus anthology, you know, series of films. What happens at the very, very end, and then all the lights go out, and you know, you just hear what's happening, and it's great that it's not actually shown, because what your imagination can do is always more frightening than what you can see, always. And I think that is used so effectively in this. I'll just, you know, for not to spoil it, but it involves a maze of razor wire and some very, very hungry dogs. It's very good.
That's quite a combination. Excellent film. Stories are well told. The cinematography is excellent. So we're both pretty strong on Tales from the Crypt from 1972. Later in 72, Amicus decides to double up. They do two anthologies in the same year, and they come up with a film called Asylum. It's another one written by Robert Bloch, and it's an interesting film in that it's an anthology, but it also plays a little bit like a single narrative, because so much of the story takes place in this mental institution. There are four stories, three of which are flashbacks. I had kind of a funny reaction when I first saw this film. Maybe I was sleepy or I didn't feel well. I didn't like it. Then I watched it recently in preparation for this interview, and I really liked it. So I must have missed something the first time around. What are your thoughts, though, on 1972's Asylum?
I think my initial reaction to Asylum was pretty much exactly the same as yours, Bruce. Like, when I think it's because, again, like, especially if you're watching these films in sequence, which is a fun way to watch them, because there's definitely an evolution throughout them of how Amicus, you know, figures out how to tell these stories and, you know, different ways and the source material they choose to use. The first time I saw Asylum, I think it's, you know, coming after especially House That Dripped Blood and Tales from the Crypt, when I first watched Asylum, I was a little disappointed with it. Like, I didn't think it was a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination. But I definitely did feel like a letdown after, you know, the previous two films. But upon rewatching it, I do like it much better. Like, I still would put it below the previous two films, but it's got some really interesting stuff in it, and again, like, it's Robert Bloch, so you're never going to waste your time there. It almost reminds me a little bit of, you know, the old Grand Guignol French plays, especially like there's one that's set in an asylum called Dr. Tar and Dr. Feather, something like that. The frame story reminds me of that a little bit. It's like, oh, try and guess which of these patients holds this secret. But I think there's some really effective stories in here. I think my favorite one of them is the first one, I think. Frozen Fear, even though it even though it uses something that has been used before in an Amicus anthology, the whole like disembodied limbs thing, which Dr. Terror's House of Horror uses. But in that previous movie, it's just a hand. But in Frozen Fear, it's a corpse that has been completely dismembered and wrapped up and put in a freezer. So, but all the different body parts, you know, reanimate and come after. And it's both, it is simultaneous. And the fact that they're, when you see them, they're still like wrapped up in this like plastic wrap kind of stuff, I think makes it, but it's funny and also intensely creepy at the same time, which is a lovely combination. And I love Frozen Fear too, because you know you get to see Barbara Parkins, who is famous for, of course, Valley of the Dolls and the TV series version of Peyton Place, you know, who didn't have a huge movie career after that. So it's nice to see her on film again, and also the great, great actor, Sylvia Sims. You know, so it's really fun to see both of them play in Frozen Fear.
What'd you think of the special effects with the disembodied parts? I was surprised how good they were for the era.
It is, yeah. Like, even, you know, because I think the hand from Dr. Terror in 1965 is very impressive. But yeah, especially when I watched it again fairly recently, you know, to prep for a conversation, like I was like, how did they do that, like in 1972? Like, it's so, you know, you don't see wires or anything. Like, it looks very, very effective. Like, it's believable. Great.
I think it's the last story with Herbert Lahm, great and prolific actor who just passed away a few years ago. It's the story of the miniature robots that have human heads. I think they're pretty effective too.
I agree with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's sort of that again, that combination of like this is almost funny, but is just ventures over into this sort of uncanniness. That the more you look at it, the more sort of upsetting and disturbing it becomes.
Yeah. I'm curious, Josh, what you thought of the Peter Cushing story where he plays a man that asks a struggling tailor to make a suit out of this very strange glowing material. What'd you think of that one?
I really enjoy it. The weird tailor story. For me, this one, it almost has the flavor of kind of like a Grimm's fairy tale in a way. And I find that really enjoyable. And again, it's kind of like, similarly to the, you know, Poetic Justice, the Peter Cushing story in Tales from the Crypt, like it has like this really like human emotional underpinning to it that I think elevates the horror. I think that's always a truth. And it's definitely true here.
Am I correct in saying the material was glowing? Was that the effect they were trying to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's kind of an interesting segment. You mentioned Barbara Parkins is in this. I talked about Herbert Lahm. You've also got Britt Eklund, Patrick McGee. So, you know, another great cast of characters in Asylum. Next film up from 1973, Tracy is going to introduce that one for us. Tracy?
So this one is The Vault of Horror from 1973, and it features five stories. And I found this one intriguing, and I watched this afternoon, and three of the little stories, you know, really stood out for me. And, you know, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts were and what one of those stories was your favorite.
I mean, for me, for this one, my favorite is definitely the first story, Midnight Mess. And there's kind of a nostalgic reason for that. When I was a kid, there were these sort of novelizations, but like written versions of stories from like the Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror comics that were sort of rewritten for younger readers, and contained some of the original illustrations from the comics. So I collected those when I was like 8 years old. I still have them. I'm with my name written in crayon. But one of the stories, and the only one from any of the Amicus adaptations that it was in the book, these books too, was Midnight Mess. So that's a story that I love since I was a kid. And, you know, it's about, just very briefly, it's about a brother who comes to this small town looking for his sister. And the town, there's something off about the town. Like, people are like looking at him like, why are you here? Even the sister's like, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. He goes to eat at a restaurant and they're like, oh, sorry, we're closing. And he's like, what do you mean? It's like 4 or 5 o'clock or whatever. And it's because the sun's going down, which leads to different developments. But I really love it. Like, I think it has just such a creepy vibe with sort of the daytime version of the town. And then, you know, the version of the town that happens once the sun has set. And this story, I think, has one of the most depending on which version you watch, but it has one of the most gruesome endings to a story of what you see visually. You know, because in the U.S., the ending of the Midnight Mess segment was censored, so that you don't see a very gory, disturbing image. Which is a real shame, because it's really well done. Sometimes on YouTube, you can come across the British version that has the uncensored version. It's still effective even when you don't see what they're talking about. It's still clear what is being done to the person at the end and his neck. Seeing it is a real shocker, if you can.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh, listen, I had no idea that there was a censored version in the United States. I did see the version that you're speaking of, the original British one.
Oh, good.
And oh my goodness, that really kind of jarred me. I was not expecting to see that, I guess, him being drinking up like that. That kind of really threw me for a loop. But
yeah. Yes.
But wow, did it leave an impression on me? I'm telling you, that was one of the ones that really intrigued me. So thank you for letting me know about the censored version. I didn't know that.
What are other ones that stand out to you, Tracy?
Oh, so the other one that I thought was kind of quirky was the episode called The Neat Job, where the husband, he's so very detail-oriented. It kind of gave me like the Stepford Wives vibes. But man, I thought that was a pretty cool story with a great ending.
Yeah, no, I love that one too. And it's kind of a fun, like, again, like we were talking about, like with the DC comics, like, They're kind of morality plays, so sometimes the endings are really satisfying. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them that I'm like, oh yes, good for you. Like, you know. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Go ahead, Bruce.
Was that the story with Terry Thomas had kind of a comical feel to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he was really annoying in that particular story.
Yeah, Terry Thomas is such a fascinating actor because, like, he can only do that one thing, but he does it really well in everything, in every movie I've ever seen him in. Like, just sort of this, like, British annoying twit. Like, he's great at it. Great at it.
It certainly worked in that story, I will tell you that for sure. I was annoyed by it.
Yeah.
The other one that I really was quite amazed was, that was kind of freaky, was the third one, which was This Trick Will Kill You. This Trick Will Kill You. What did you think about that? I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that one too. And again, you know, like we've been talking about with like all the disembodied limbs over some of the movies. Like, I think the effects work in This Trick Will Kill You is quite impressive. too for the time. It's just like, oh wow, how did they make the rope do that, you know, and look so convincing. Yeah.
The actor in that is a man named Kurd Jurgens, and he was in the Mephisto Waltz with Alan Alda. He's not an actor I know a lot about, but in those two films, I thought he did a really good job. What'd you think of the fifth story about the artist who uses voodoo and it's able to make his paintings into a weapon, even though he didn't know that was going to be the effect of it?
Yeah, I think that's Drawn and Quartered. It's an interesting one, too. And, you know, it's also fun because it stars Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor Who. We get both the third and the fourth Doctors in the Amicus anthology series, which is fantastic. Yeah, I think this one's really interesting because it takes the voodoo story element, which is in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors as well, and I think done well there, although I think that sequence is a little bit overlong for me. But in Drawn and Quartered, you know, it takes the voodoo, but also blends it with like the picture of Dorian Gray and, you know, kind of thing as well, you know, where, you know, what happens to the painting happens in life. So I think it's a really fascinating blend that I think really works. It probably shouldn't work, but it does. And I think Tom Baker is just fantastic in it. And it's a treat seeing him, I think, you know, as playing someone other than the Doctor. It might have been the first time I'd seen him as something other than Doctor Who. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I really liked it. I don't have any point of comparison to Doctor Who because I've never really watched the show. I sense that you and Tracy probably have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was I was brought up watching it. My mom got me into it when I was a little kid, you know. So, it was tough when I was growing up because, like, no one knew what Doctor Who was. So it's not like I could, like, talk about it at school. So, like, you know, now that the revival series has been on and there's, like, Doctor Who merchandise everywhere and everyone knows what it is, like, still kind of feels bizarre and miraculous to me. Because, like, when I was growing up, if you wanted merch, you had to, like, get it from England, like, you know. Yeah.
Tracy, what about you? Are you a Doctor Who fan?
I have only ever seen a few episodes of Doctor Who, but they're the more recent ones that I've seen. I've not seen any of the originals. So but very famous, definitely a very famous series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of great actors have played that role. Yeah. David Tennant being one of my favorites. So Vault of Horror, the sixth of the Amicus anthologies, kind of a movie that has a bit of everything. Vampirism, evil magic, voodoo, grave robbery, and I think certainly one of the stronger of these seven anthologies. So that brings us to our seventh and final Amicus film in the anthology realm. This is a film that came out in 1974 called From Beyond the Grave. It's a very good movie. It features five stories centered on the proprietor who runs the Temptations Antique Shop. It's a great name. Peter Cushing plays this pallid but friendly proprietor, and he will sell attractive antiques that carry an unwanted surprise for anyone who either buys them or, in one case, tries to steal them. Interesting. I wrote about this on the Ghostly Gallery Facebook page a few weeks ago, and I said it's a good movie. I gave it 3 stars. I got roasted for doing that. People were like, you're really underselling this. This is a great movie. This is a 4-star film. So maybe I missed something. I thought it was very good, but people thought I should have said it was great. What do you think, Josh?
So at the risk of being roasted myself, I would agree. I agree with you, Bruce. Because again, for me, like, I think House of the Drip Blood and Tales from the Crypt are like the pinnacle of the Amicus anthology movies. While From Beyond the Grave, I think is a very good film, I wouldn't put it on the same tier as those two. It is interesting, you know, again, talking about sort of the phases that Amicus goes through, you know, we have Robert Bloch, and then there's the EC Comics movies too. And now in From Beyond the Grave, it moves into sort of its third and final phase, adapting short stories by R. Chetwin Hayes, who I might be wrong, but I don't think is as known now in the United States as he is in England. He's still very, very highly regarded in England. But, you know, it feels like a very nice bookend for me, I think, you know, because you have Peter Cushing playing the proprietor of Temptations Limited, the antique shop. So, you know, it's nice having him back in sort of the same kind of archetypal role that he had as Dr. Terror in the first Amicus movie in 1965. I think the stories are all pretty strong, and I do give From Beyond the Grave a lot of credit in that it does venture into sort of different kinds of stories and themes in terms of the supernatural than we've seen previously in the Amicus films. Like, if anything, like that, I think that's my one criticism for The Vault of Horror, and that it does kind of start dipping into kinds of stories that Amicus has done before. But R. Chetwin Hayes was just a very interesting writer, and did not write about like the usual kind of paranormal story. So I think it's a really refreshing thing here with this movie to tackle his work.
There's a story at the beginning with the great British actor David Warner. Then you've got one with both Donald Pleasance and his daughter Angela Pleasance. And then later on, Ian Ogilvy, Leslie Ann Down appear. Do you have a favorite story from this one, Josh?
I like them all pretty equally, but I do find the third story, The Elemental, might be my favorite. Either that or the next one, The Door. But I've always found the whole concept of like an elemental spirit really frightening, that it's this sort of primeval force. Like, it's not a ghost, like it's not like it is something that, like, ancient, you know. So I think there's something and you don't really see that elemental spirit thing used a lot in horror for some reason, so I think it's really refreshing to see it done here. And I also really enjoy, as I said, the final story, the door, you know, that, you know, the other room beyond it and what happens there. And it's also fun because it's kind of one of my favorite series of all time is Upstairs Downstairs, you know, so seeing Ian Ogilvy and Leslie Ann Down, who are both in Upstairs Downstairs acting together in a movie in this is like a nice fun little reunion, even though they weren't on the show at the same time.
What about you? Yeah, it's a good, stylish production. Very good. When I give movies 3 stars, I think some people think that's an insult, but 3 stars is good. 4 makes it a classic. I wouldn't quite put it in that category, but it's good. It's beautifully shot. Great interiors. There's a lot of atmosphere. You've got some humor that's thrown in. Anything with David Warner is going to be a hit with me. Of course, Cushing is fantastic too. So it's very good. I think it's a pretty good conclusion to what Amicus did from Beyond the Grave in 1974. And speaking of Amicus, this is very interesting, but there's been a lot of talk, substantial talk, that Amicus is coming back. And Tracy, you were telling me off air that it's advanced to the point where they've begun production on a new film for the new Amicus. The original Amicus went out of business in 1977, but in 2023, it was announced that Amicus would return, new people at the helm, and they've apparently started production on a film. Tell us more about it, Tracy.
Yeah, so it looks like the Scottish filmmaker, and I believe it's Laurie Brewster, has started a Kickstarter, and it's going to help with Amicus's return. And the movie is called In the Grip of Terror. It has 4 stories. As of right now, there's no release date yet. It's still in production because it does rely on the Kickstarter for the funding. But they do say that this film will be finished and released to the public at some point, which is quite exciting.
Yeah,
Josh, what do you think about bringing back Amicus? It was so good the first time around. Sometimes it's hard to revive something like that. But what do you think about the effort?
I think it's great. And when I first heard that this was happening and about the Kickstarter, and especially that they were going to start back up again with an anthology film, I was so ecstatic, you know, because I think what they did was really special. You know, through these anthology movies, and also you can kind of include the Monster Club from 1981 in that list too. You know, because even though it wasn't officially an Amicus movie, it was Milton Sobotsky produced it. It was R. Chetwynd Haynes' stories again, anthology. Only time Vincent Price played a vampire on screen in a movie. It's really that's a really fun one. And you know, that movie ends with Vincent Price saying, like, humans are the worst monsters of all. You are now an honorary member of the Monster Club. And I love that because I think it sums up what Amicus was doing with these films and why I enjoy them so much and why I, frankly, and this I might get hate for this, but like, I like the Amicus films overall more than I do Hammer films. You know, the Hammer films are, of course, very, very famous, very well done. But I love the Amicus anthologies, especially because even though there are supernatural elements to most of these stories, it's not all of them, but in all of the stories, it is primarily about the bad things human beings do to one another, you know, either through cruelty or hubris or, you know, greed. And they're also set in the modern day, you know, at the time. They're not period pieces like many of the Hammer films were. So I think their work in horror always has really resonated with me in that, like, it's set in the now or the now of that time period, and that it is about the horror that human beings do to one another and how the supernatural intersects with that, but is not usually the cause of the bad behavior in any of these movies. And like, I think that's just a really cool thesis to make movies about. So I'm thrilled that Amicus is coming back with the anthology, and I will be the first one to buy a ticket for that movie when it comes out.
Oh my gosh. Both of you speak with such passion on these Amicus movies. You know, I've only watched a few, but I'm definitely really inspired to watch the remainder. I have the whole list in front of me. So, you know, I think this is great. You've won me over.
Great retrospective, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah. The great thing with them too is that, you know, they are pretty easy to find, you know, like, you know, between like Amazon Prime, Tubi, and YouTube, like you can see all these guys. It's great.
Excellent history on Amicus Productions from Josh Hitchens. Josh, before I let you go, I do want to get thoughts on another Amicus movie. It's not an anthology. Celebrates 50th anniversary, April of 1974 is when it came out. Hard to believe it's been 50 years. We spent a good part of an earlier episode in April talking about the anniversary of The Beast Must Die. But I want to get your thoughts because you really like this movie. Tell us why.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I love The Beast Must Die. I think it is a hoot. So I am a huge Agatha Christie fan, have been since I was a kid. Read all her books many times over. But one of my favorites of hers is And Then There Were None, and all its many, many iterations on film. And, you know, of course, you know, premise of And Then There Were None is like these people are, you know, on this island, you know, people start dying. They realize it must be one of them. And so I love The Beast Must Die because it is Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, but with werewolf. And that just makes it even better. It's like murder mystery and horror coming together, like some of my favorite things. And I love that the beast must die. A is really fun, like doesn't take itself too seriously. Like it there, and you can tell the actors have had a ball making it. But I love that it also, at least for me, is a legitimately great mystery in itself. The first time I saw The Beast Must Die, when they reveal who the werewolf is, I was like, oh my God, it's that person. Like it totally fooled me. But, you know, but when you find out who the werewolf is, for me anyway, like it totally made sense. And also again, like provides a little like emotional underpinning, you know, to the identity of the werewolf. I think it's great. I think more people need to watch The Beast Must Die.
It's a film that has Peter Cushing. He's not the lead. And I think the star of the film actually outdoes him. Not a well-known actor, but he's phenomenal in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's also refreshing, I think, too, you know, to have, you know, the lead actor in The Beast Must Die be a person of color, you know, who is not playing like a monster. Like it's not, you know, not God knows, like I love Blackula, and Blackula is hugely important in film history, and especially in like horror representation with folks of color. But it's I love the casting in The Beast Must Die of the lead actor. Yeah, and he's fantastic. Like, yeah, you're right. Like, absolutely carries the movie and out-acts everyone, including Peter Cushing. Yeah. And that's not easy to do, but he does.
As an actor who passed away a number of years ago, and he's not a household name, Calvin Lockhart was his name, and he did quite a few films in the 60s and 70s. I had a very distinctive way of speaking in this film. I'm not sure if that was his natural speaking pattern or something that he adopted for the film, but it works effectively. When he's on screen, he dominates not only with his speech pattern, but his all leather outfits, his 1970s wear. Visually, he creates a striking pose as well. Calvin Lockhart, just phenomenal in this movie. And Cushing is great too, as an expert on lycanthropy. It's also a film with Michael Gambon, who recently passed away, a very noted British actor. And then you had Charles Gray, who was outstanding in the Hammer film about witchcraft, The Devil Rides Out, goes by another title as well. It's the one with Christopher Lee in the good guy role. So it's a great cast. It's fast moving, as you say. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it takes itself seriously enough that you're really trying to guess who the killer is. Final question about this. What'd you think about the werewolf break that they had, the 30-second timeout where they ask you to ponder who the werewolf is?
I am a fan of the werewolf break. I know the director absolutely loathed it. Like that was not supposed to be in the movie. That was the producer saying, no, we're doing this. And the director hated it. But I think it's fun. I think it goes it keeps with the spirit of the film, you know, and also, which, you know, again, it doesn't take itself too seriously, but does take itself seriously, like as a mystery. And I like that it takes that that moment, that little bit of a pause, to remind the audience, like, okay, well, what do you think? Who do you think is the werewolf killer here? You know, whereas like, you know, other movies, they would just show you and tell you. But I like that Beast Must Die creates this little blip of time. You're like, oh, let me actually think about this. So even though it was not the director's original intention, I think it works for the movie. I really do.
Yeah. Like you, I had no idea who it was. Came as a big surprise. Final question, Josh, before we let you go. Any projects coming up for you? Anything new that you're working on?
Sure. So my third book, which is called Eerie Delaware, Chilling Tales from the First State, is coming out little less than a month from now. It comes out May 27th of this year, released by Arcadia Publishing. It's available for pre-order from them and from like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, all those places as well. But it's, I think, the most fun book I've written so far, in that, you know, the first two books I wrote were pretty much exclusively ghost stories. But with the Eerie series that Arcadia Publishing does, it allowed me to have a much sort of broader canvas. So, you know, there are definitely ghost stories, but there's also like folklore and legends. There's cryptids, there's witches, there's, you know, history of alien encounters in Delaware. There's also some three true crime chapters in there as well. So it's a very eclectic mix of content that I hope people really enjoy, and has great creepy illustrations too by an artist named Jason McLean, who, you know, took the text I wrote and created these amazing images from them. So that's coming out May 27th. And for anyone who's listening who is local to Philadelphia, I now have a monthly live horror hosting show at a wonderful venue called the Painted Mug Cafe, which is located in South Philadelphia. And it is a queer space that decentralizes drugs and alcohol. And they have lots of really great events there. But yeah, I'm going to be doing a monthly live horror hosting screening series. The show is called Movie Mug Cob, because Painted Mug Cafe smashed up with Movie Macabre, which was Elvira's original show, of course. And on May 25th, it's going to be the last Saturday of every month. And on May 25th, which will be the next show, I'm going to be hosting the Phantom of the Opera, the classic Lon Chaney from 1925. So if you're in Philadelphia or nearby, come on out for that. It's going to be a good time.
Oh, so that sounds so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to show a film and then comment on it, a la Joe Bob Briggs?
Yeah. So yeah, I'll do, I did a pilot version of it in May, where I showed Plan 9 from Outer Space, because of course they all have to be public domain. Yeah. So I do an intro to the film, you know, about talking about the history, you know, interesting making of stuff about it. And I do like a mid-film segment, and then a closing at the end. But yeah, it's going to be a fun time.
Very good. That's coming up in Philly, and also the new book, Eerie Delaware, scheduled for release May 27th. Josh, as always, our gratitude to you. Thank you very much for another insightful hour plus here on the gallery. Thanks.
Thank you both so much for having me on again. It's always a treat talking to you both.
Our guest, Josh Hitchens, kind of a renaissance man of horror, does it all: writer, author, playwright, actor, horror host. We're adding that one to the collection as well. Our thanks to Josh and, of course, my co-host and producer, Tracy Asteria. We thank both of them. We thank all of you for listening as well, joining us in this Museum of the Macabre. And we hope we'll see you next time right here in the Ghostly Gallery.